Welcome to Warning Shot, a new look at foreign policy with your hosts, Joel Rubin, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, and Endy Zemenides, Executive Director of the Hellenic American Leadership Council. Now here's Joel and Endy.
Welcome back to Warning Shot. Endy Zemenides with Joel Rubin. We're both trying to outdo the blue and white in honor of Greek Independence Day.
Yay!
Joel, it is the end of the bicentennial of the Greek Revolution, and I find it relevant, not because I'm Greek today, but because of Ukraine's fight for freedom. This was the first national liberation movement in Europe. It was the first nation state to rebel against empires. And 200 years later, the Ukrainians are fighting for that again, a nation state, a national liberation. And what do you think about that?
Well, it's exciting. Congratulations on the bicentennial. The Greek people, the Greek community here in America, it's a well-deserved celebration. Greek Americans add so much vibrance to the United States. I love I have a few Greece stories of travels back in the day through the islands and fell in love with the country as well. So this is a beautiful moment. And Greece is stepping up big time right now on Ukraine, seeking to send aid, providing political support, doing the right thing, picking the right side.
And reversing its longstanding policy of not getting involved in conflicts abroad and giving weapons to Ukraine.
I mean, this is a the right sign, right? Like, this is what we want. What we want is countries at this moment, this crucial pivot moment, this inflection point about what it means to be a democracy versus an autocracy. You got to choose, and countries are choosing. President Biden's actually going to talk about that tomorrow in a speech in Warsaw about democracies versus autocracies. And so Greek Americans, congratulations. You should feel proud. Your native lands, they're choosing the right side in this fight.
Yeah. And with that, talking about over there again, we told you last time we had to cancel Brian Karem's appearance on the last episode because he was escaping shooting. But fortunately, we're happy to report that he escaped safely, and he joins us today. Brian, we're glad you're safe. Thanks for joining us again. And I'm going to kick off with again, sticking with the Greek Independence Day theme. One of the Revolutionary War heroes, he had a quote years into the revolution where he said, he addressed the Greeks. He said, God signed for our freedom and he's not taking his signature back. It seems that the Ukrainians are taking that to heart. They've tasted freedom. They're not going to go down without the biggest fight the Russians have ever seen.
Well, Putin will never be able to conquer the country. There's just, you know, I've been there. The Ukrainian people have a great sense of humor and a great sense of anger and a great sense of honor. It's their land. There's a great bus stops everywhere. There's posters that say, this is our land. We'll stand our ground and you'll be in it. So they're not going anywhere. I ran into a Russian farmer a Ukrainian farmer about 40 miles southwest of Kyiv, and he said, "I hear you Americans have lots of guns. Bring them over here, and we'll kill a lot of Russian bears."
Wow.
They very salty people.
The wrong country to invade.
There was a story that said Ukraine is a Texas of Eastern Europe.
The numbers are crazy. Sorry, Brian. Go ahead.
That's the birthplace of the Cossacks. You think that maybe, you know, it's right there in the steppes. It's a breadbasket of Europe. It's a beautiful country. I mean,
not a soft country. Yeah.
Not. And I'll tell you how hard it is. I mean, there's some hard living in the hinterlands of Ukraine. There are people still riding around in horse and buggy, you know, taking their wares to market. Their homes that have no electricity, and they heat their home with cordwood that they cut down in the forest. I mean, these people are hardy, very strong people. They still are in open air markets despite air raid sirens, which would scare the living bejesus out of most Americans. They go about their daily business, and they are, you know, there's a, I'll quote it in Ukrainian, and it's they say Putin huilo, which means, you know, Putin is a, you know, F head. And, you know, so they say that quite up. I'm grabbing, you know, talking to basically refugees and displaced persons from Mariupol. I talked to a family who lived across from the theater that was marked, you know, clearly marked. You could see it from space. It said in Russian, children, they bombed it. And they bombed their apartment complex floor by floor by floor. They leveled it. These people were living in a bomb shelter, communal bomb shelter, for 5 days. Had to help bury some of their friends who got killed in their own front yard. They managed to escape from Mariupol. Hadn't had a meal in 2 days when I found them at the New Hope Mission in Lviv. And, you know, you would have thought that that would humble many a people. They were angry, and they were, you know, most of the people escaping or getting out are young children and women, and a lot of them are coming back to fight. They are not going to be able. Putin, this doesn't end well for Putin. It doesn't end well for Russia. It ends with their lower, and the Ukrainian profile will be higher.
Let me ask you on this, just a little deeper on the Ukrainian people and what they're bringing to this fight and sort of how they're viewing it. How long in your assessment have they been preparing for this? Is this like, oh, the last 8 years of conflict, and so they're getting ready, and they're technically the military is organizing and the government's reforming and coming into formation? Or, you know, was it Zelensky's motivation, or is this a longer thing? Like, peel back for us, like, how long have they been sort of preparing for this kind of fight with the Russians?
Well, it's obvious they were better prepared than the Russians. That's at the depth of their preparedness, only they can attest to. But when you have a leader of the country who stands up and says, I don't need a ride, I need ammunition, that kind of no matter what your preparation is, that inspires people across the world. I mean, you know, I talk about the New Hope Mission in an article, you know, and that's not a happenstance reference to Star Wars. These people across the, you know, we in America like the plucky underdog, and everyone around the globe is rallying around Zelensky. So it's less preparation, I think, and more of the mindset is, you know, we're not going anywhere. It's our land. We'll live on it, and you'll be beneath it. So that's that. I think they have been prepared. Obviously, they're prepared. Obviously, the Russians' tactics have, you know, they're not prepared, and they're drawing in people from around the world. One of the most moving things I saw was a Zoom press conference that I was in with mayors around Ukraine and mayors from around the world who had joined in and pledged their support and help for the people of Ukraine. And to watch, you know, a mayor from Dublin almost in tears saying, you are our brothers and sisters, we will come to your aid. And you have the mayors of Ukraine going, we're standing up for the European ideals that we all respect. Please help us. And then the mayor of Kyiv, you know, the former boxer, who said, look, this is the biggest war since World War II. If you don't think this involves you, you're wrong. It's to many people, it's already World War III. The fear is it becoming nuclear. And the real fear, the concern is, can we strangle the Russian bear to death with economic sanctions and choke the life out of them? Whatever happens, like I said, I think at the end of the day, as long as we don't end up blowing up the world, I think Russia will end up being in a far lower place. And it's really sad for the Russian people because Putin has put them in that position.
But Ukraine's going to be in a worse place too, despite terrorism. But I mean, Ukraine's going to be in a worse place. Just you have 10 million refugees and internally displaced people.
Oh, well, in the short,
You know, you talked about Mariupol. I think Ukraine will stand this, but Mariupol, you know, the last Western diplomat out of Mariupol was Greece's historically.
And I'm wearing the blue today for you,
that's
brother.
That's right. Historic home of a large Greek community. But he came and he was almost in tears, and he said that Mariupol is going the way of Aleppo. What is you know, is that eastern part of Ukraine? And because we saw the supposed 15-point peace plan that that Russia is trying to float through Turkey, you know, what's going to be the status of the eastern Ukraine? Is Russia going to hold on to it?
That's the big question, because Mariupol is very strategic at this point for Russian aims, linking up property that they've seized in the Crimea and to the south and the east. Mariupol was much like Bastogne was in World War II, where it was at the crossroads, and the Germans wanted to link it up to help out their advance through Belgium. This is the same thing. Mariupol is that city. And the fact that it's not fallen is very frustrating to the Russians, because then they can't link up a contiguous state. And I think they would call it, you know, a draw at that. But Ukrainians are not having any of it. And they're not going to give it up. And it's never going to be captured. And it's been leveled. And to your point, I think in the short term, Ukraine suffers. But in the long term, Ukraine will rise from this and will be a much stronger nation, and Russia will be a much weaker nation.
There's a prediction for you guys. Let's everybody watch that. And I think that maybe I think Brian's right. If they got Mariupol and got their land bridge, they'd call it
But I want to ask a strategic question on that then. So what's the point, right? Like, what's the end game here for Russia?
That's a good question.
What are they actually trying to get done by even having a rump Eastern Ukrainian annexed occupied territory indefinitely, right? Like, which would essentially mean they will never get out from global sanctions, by the way, right? Like, this sanctions thing is not like a 2-week gambit. This is a permanent thing until Russia fully withdraws. And the Ukrainian government says that's the right that's good. And now we see yesterday NATO, the EU, the European countries, Biden saying we're going to move off of Russian oil and gas. And that's not an immediate change, obviously. But now that there's a policy shift, that's a long term problem for Russia. So what is Russia's actual point here? What are they trying to get?
Well, the end game question is a wonderful question. Look, the mayors of Ukraine and around the world are convinced, and by his actions, he has shown that Putin wants to reunite the Soviet Union. That's his goal. Right. And this is a necessary step in achieving that goal. Now, there are plenty of people who think Putin's gone completely nuts, or had a stroke or a heart attack or early onset dementia, or perhaps an STD that's driving him crazy. Nobody knows. Nobody's close enough to know that. We can only see by his actions that it's kind of nutty. I mean, the man is not stupid, or hasn't proven to be stupid in the past. Yeah. And the Ukrainian people are very stubborn, independent people. That's always been the case. So he knew that going in, and you know, thinking that it would be like a 2 or 3 day sojourn and that people would welcome them as heroes, that's just nuts. So the end game, I don't know what the end game is, and I don't think anybody else does. I don't think Putin does. I think he got into this without an end game in mind, other than the fact that it would be over in 3 days. Not well thought out. I mean, you left a tank column, a 40-mile tank column on the ground for God knows how long, and a lot of that got destroyed. There are tales of, I mean, and let me tell you how really deviously conniving and stubborn Ukrainian people are. They're in the invaded zones. There are talks of, and I've spoken with people who said they saw it happen, that Ukrainian women were using Tinder to lure young Russian boys into, you know, places where they thought they were going to have a good time, and they ended up killing them.
Honey traps.
Yeah, baby. And it's not, these people don't want to go gentle in that good night. So the end game, where are we at now with an end game? Do you call it a draw and walk away? Do you the real fear, especially today, I got some advance notice that with Biden going, there's a real concern about, you know, gas attacks, terrorist attacks. They're not going to ever be able to advance on Lviv. They will never be able to be there. But what they can do, there are Russians there who have been there for years that can initiate terror attacks with gas or explosives and terrorize the populace. We've already seen some of that terrorization going on with the many air raid sirens that will keep people up all night long, and then there's no air raid. At some point in time, Lviv, they're going to drop something and scare everybody back into submission. It's all terror. It's all psychological. But an end game, I don't see an end game where Russia comes out of this well. That's the best I can tell you. And I don't see an end game that the Ukrainian nation doesn't come out of this suffering, but ultimately in a better place than Russia.
You know, I want to jump in on this because, Andy, I know this is stuff you love. Vladimir Putin, you know, is already RSVP'd for the upcoming G20 summit. And yesterday, Joe Biden said, kick Russia out of the G20. They're out of the G8, now G7, as they should have been kicked out. Love to hear your thoughts on what that means to Russia. What does that mean to Vladimir Putin? What's sort of the bigger picture now out of the war, the battle on the ground, where Russia's in terms of Russia's position in the world?
Hell, man, maybe Russia might not even be eligible the way the sanctions are having. They might not be a G20 country at all. But I will say this, going back to this mastermind, he's a genius. And I would like to kick it back both to you and Brian, because I've never thought he was a genius. I thought he was taking advantage of chaos in the West.
Bully.
Right. And we've had a Western alliance that has been fractured for a lot of reasons. The EU never came together the way it's supposed to. The Iraq war created, you know, Donald Rumsfeld's famous old Europe versus new Europe in the United States. The West was going in different directions. And Vladimir Putin got to play an opponent that was vulnerable to chaos, and he's a chaos candidate. But looking at the pictures yesterday, that extraordinary NATO, EU, G7 meeting. Now, there were people in those pictures, and we can come back to it later, that I'm not particularly thrilled with, Orban, Erdogan, so on and so forth. But the fact is, he has done more to unite the West than
Then I'm going to disagree with you. He is a genius. He has found the one way to unite the West that no one else in the West.
Is he our useful idiot?
Yeah, I'll agree with you on this. That I think he's conniving. I think he's a bully. I think he took advantage of the fact that he has a nuclear button. He could threaten people with it. And I think that that's exactly how he's been successful. And I think he played Donald Trump. He's an agent of chaos. Donald Trump loves that kind of, you know, crap, and sucked up to him for all it was worth. And now you're stuck with somebody who's going,
But it was more than Donald Trump, Brian, right?
Oh, yeah, no, Donald Trump was
traitor in Germany. You had the former chancellor being a paid agent of Vladimir Putin. You had these oligarchs and Russian billionaires who were going around, especially the Balkans and Southeast Europe, and buying up everything, becoming major employers at a time where we, the West, including the U.S., were telling all these countries, you got to fire, you got to go in austerity measures.
Well, to your point, I was speaking with a British businessman yesterday who's he works for an American company. He's in advertising. They had a meeting. They came to Poland for a meeting. The CEO flew for this meeting. And notoriously, here's a country or a company that doesn't spend a lot on advertising in Ukraine or Poland or anywhere else. They decided to increase the amount of money that they spend for advertising there. They broke they broke off relationships that they've had for 15 years with Russian investors and Russian people who had worked for this company. It has united the West in a way that's completely unforeseen on many levels. In business, in diplomacy, and it's going to, and to your point, I don't think that, I don't see how Russia comes out of this in any way, shape, or form ahead of the game.
I think there's really two sort of ways for Russia to get back into the business of being a normal country. The first is to fully exit Ukraine and have the Ukrainian government support that. And the second is for Vladimir Putin to no longer be running the country. And that's how Russia gets back in. Absent those two, Russia is in for a very dark, long haul period. But what you've both described is sort of Russia and Vladimir Putin using nuclear extortion and energy extortion to manipulate and maneuver. Now, the nuclear is still on the table, and we should talk about that, and it's a never-ending conversation about how to deal with that. But the energy extortion is disappearing quickly. And, what is the breakpoint? Now, throw this out to the table, but Brian, you're our guest here. What is the breakpoint when the leaders at the top of Russia do what they need to do, and they just say, good God, we are now getting so pushed out, we need to meet these two criteria, and they move on Putin? What is the breakpoint?
I think seizing the yachts was a breakpoint. Mm-hmm. I think at some point in time, I think what Biden is trying to do has a bit of genius to it, and trying to choke the living crap out of the Russian economy, and forcing these people who do business worldwide to say, look, you guys like to do business? We like to do business. Get rid of this guy and we can go back to doing business. So he's leaving it up to them without an overt threat that the best way Russia goes forward is without Vladimir Putin, whether that is he steps aside or something else happens, peacefully or not peacefully. The message has been sent, right? And they've caught that. Who's the leader that we haven't seen for 14 days in Russia? What happened to him? That's going to be up to Russia. But remember the ominous saying, and I can't remember who it was in Russia, like last week, who said to Vladimir Putin, don't take us back to 1917. Well, that's pretty telling on a couple of levels, because I think that's when the Tsar was assassinated and around that time. And so it's frightening that, there are Russians that get it. How they move, when they move, how can they move is I don't know. And I don't think any of us do, because that's a very closed system. And I think we can speculate, but I think you're right. I don't see Russia getting out and with the people in Ukraine and with Zelensky supporting it with Putin in charge. And if Putin isn't in charge, then that takes care of a lot of problems. How that happens, when that happens, I tell you, it's going to the next. I've said this before, and I'll continue to say it, and I've said it for the last month. So I think the next 30 to 60 days determines the future of the planet for the next 30 to 60 years.
There's a couple of things about this conversation, though, that leave me queasy. A couple things.
It always leaves me queasy.
No, but like one, we're giving this agency to these oligarchs, and let's not remember there were oligarchs that there was a previous set of oligarchs that Putin got rid of. So I'm not sure that oligarchs are as powerful or they're just feeding off of Putin. So
or he's feeding off him.
And then the second that really raised alarm bells was Dmitry Peskov, his spokesman, saying, we might use nukes if we feel there's an existential threat. So if our strategy is really, if the Western strategy is we're going to go until the Russians get rid of Putin, if we're hellbent there, and let's remember, we couldn't get rid of Assad since 2014. The world was almost united on that front, and they couldn't get rid of.
And now we got the Emiratis rehabilitating
because of Russia and Iran.
That's not Russia, and this is a different ballgame. And that's apples and oranges, and this is an existential threat to the world. And you're right; it leaves me very queasy because, as mm-hmm. I said, the next 30 or 60 days are going to answer a lot of those questions. And folks, I got to tell you that the people who say this is already World War III, they're right. The world is already there by proxy it's Ukraine fighting nationally, but by proxy, man, I've seen French, British, the base that got blown up was blown up because there were Brits there training Ukrainians. And by the way, they tracked them through their cell phones and they were able to find them and target them based on the GPS in their cell phones. The Russians on one hand are very primitive and on another hand, very sophisticated. Their tactics on the ground are horrible. But their hacking abilities are great and their missiles work. Although if you listen to some of them, it's, a lot of them don't. But it's the next 30 or 60 days. If there's one boot step, they step 1 foot into Poland, it's over with, or Moldova, or Slovakia, or anywhere else. And they're trying to
strike. So what do you mean over with? I mean, we're not going to go into Russia. You think we're going to send troops into Russia?
We will send troops into the battlefield.
Yes, but on NATO soil.
If NATO soil is still World War III,
that's going to be everybody in.
Well,
I got this for you. I've been there. Everyone is in.
This is part of what they talked about yesterday. Just bring back some of the stuff yesterday in Brussels as well, which is the obviously the Article 5 and the ironclad commitment to NATO's defense and security. But there are also some subtle things put in there on nuclear doctrine, for example, where the president maintained American nuclear doctrine on response, which allows for potential nuclear response to a chem bio weapon type of attack, which is actually a backtracking of a campaign promise where he wanted to have this. He promised sole purpose of nukes is to respond to a nuke attack. That's no longer his position. So his position maintains the status quo. And so we're entering into territories where there may not be a pinprick. It may be a pinprick to a balloon. It goes pop, right? We have to be very careful.
The pinprick already occurred. We're there. The pinprick has already occurred. Everyone keeps talking about a red line. Yes. The red line's been passed.
Yes.
This is real. And that's why I say 30 to 60 days. You're talking about the backsliding on a campaign promise. It's these little subtle steps that lead us to a confrontation that from which none of us will be able to back away from, and there will be no safe place on the planet.
Except we are just being clear about this red line. I think if we have to learn to be self-critical too. We weren't clear about that red line. Unfortunately, the red line became a punchline since 2014, right? Because people don't take it seriously. We let Crimea and Donbas. We've all talked about it. Fighting has been happening for 8 years. So now finally, I think we said as a West, this is the red line. And that's why it's important, as Joel said, the new standards being set even in Brussels yesterday, that we're being clear about what we're going to tolerate and what we're not going to tolerate.
And what Brian is saying, that is a scary clarity.
Yeah, it not only is it a frightening clarity, but maybe that's all it takes to get Putin to back down, because he is a bully and people are going to go, and people close to him are going to say, hey, no more. But what I'm really concerned about is that in the next 30 or 60 days, this slide into a nuclear confrontation continues. This is how, I mean, they've gamed this out. This is not news. We know how this can lead to nuclear conflagration. And barring that, what's the end game?
Let me ask you
looking at what's happening, and that's the frightening end game. That's the one that frightens everyone.
Well, let me ask you a question we've sort of bandied about in past episodes, which a nuclear strike. Is there such a thing as a limited nuclear war?
No. I think there's one. Look, I stood in the press briefing room, and one of the dumb reporters, and I'm sorry, a dumb young reporter who doesn't know beans, said, you know, Brian, gosh, if we get in a nuclear war with Russia, I don't think we can win it. And I said, hey, you moron, it's called mutual assured destruction. Nobody wins it. When it happens, you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. You know, as the man said, I don't know how you fight this war, but the next one's going to be fought with sticks and stones if there's anyone left on the planet at all. You've got to put the nuclear genie back in the bottle, and you can't. And that's what Putin is doing to bluff the West. And at some point in time, if his bluff is called, does his finger go on the button? That's a very frightening thing. And at the same time, how do you make sure that he doesn't invade further? That's a frightening thing. Short of putting troops on the ground, strangling him to death economically seems to be what we've decided will work. And then by further giving him limits and saying, look, in case we weren't clear, idiot, don't do this, because it's going to lead to crap that none of us can control. And hopefully Putin gets that message. But like I said, 30 to 60 days from now, we'll know.
And speaking of, go ahead, Joel.
No, I mean, I had one question because I want you to put your reporter hat on this one with the president yesterday talking about sanctions and how they weren't meant to deter. And, you know, I think he means they were meant to deter, but they weren't meant to stop if Putin was going to go forward. But I wanted to get your take on sort of the language of sanctions and how to talk about them within this context.
Well, that goes to a bigger issue that I have with the Biden administration. His actions, many of his actions, I think have been sound. I think he has the worst communication staff I have ever seen. I cannot, they say one thing and they mean something else, and then they allow people to suck up the airwaves, putting their spin on what the president has done. So how sanctions work and what they're doing with the sanctions is something that should be explained daily and more often than the Biden administration wants to. I've gone in and said, look, you need to put him in front of the camera. No, he speaks to the press too much. No, he doesn't at all, because he's leaving the airwaves for everyone else to interpret what it is that he's doing. And if he's good at what he does, then what he's doing and it stops what's going on and we have a peaceful resolution to the problem in Ukraine, not only will he never get the credit for it, they'll probably say it happened in spite of him, no matter what he's definitely done as a leader. And that's because they're horrible communicating. So to your point about, you know, sanctions, deterrence, they're not a deterrence. They're a punishment. They're a way to strangle the life out of, and if that deters you, fine. But the end game for the sanctions is to make him suffer to the point where they get rid of him.
You know, all of this discussion, and we'd be remiss not to mention that we lost this week former Secretary Madeleine Albright. Since you conflated Putin with Trump, she did so in her last book too. Fascism, a warning.
Yes, that was my death way of doing that.
And you know, it would be so fascinating to hear from her now. She was a refugee that fled the Soviets advancing on her home. That shaped her political conscience as Secretary of State. Because Yugoslavia was falling apart, she was a leading force in establishing the right to protect and humanitarian intervention. And again, she calls out, she says, fascism, we thought we had beat it in the 20th century, it came back in the 21st century. And her books have, her book, Fascism, a Warning, has a picture or a chapter devoted to Putin, to Maduro, to Erdogan, to Orban, to Trump. And so a couple questions for you. One, we know you covered her, so do you have a cool Madeleine Albright story? And two, and we've been trying to get to this every show, we're going to come out of this crisis at one point. You know, Russia can be beaten at one point. But as part of that G20 picture and as part of the diplomatic effort to win this, we're also including in the alliance other people who are in Madeleine's fascism book, including Orban, including Erdogan, including Maduro. How do we balance this fight for freedom and enabling autocrats at the same time?
Well, let's see. Let's take the first one first. I'll take them in order. One of my favorite Madeleine Albright story was she didn't call the reporter stupid or naive, but it was the sneer that she gave. We were in a press conference that I was at, and they were asking her about Clinton's peccadilloes and his, some of his sexual things that led to him being impeached. And she said, well, you know, in essence, that's kind of like locker room politics. We over here in the West, we look at it one way and nobody really cares internationally. And it was the way she kind of looked down her nose. And I laughed. I still laugh to this day. It was the most brilliant, subtle put down that I'd ever seen. And then how do we deal with fascism? Boy, it would be nice to have her around for that. American people have to be better informed, more involved, and understand that their life is their own and that they should not surrender their freedoms to others. I mean, that's what we fought for, supposedly, as a nation when we began. Fascism and authoritarianism, it creeps into your life because you're too busy on a daily basis trying to make sure you get your kids to soccer practice, you can pay your bills, and that the street's paved, and you know, you worry about local stuff. And so if an authoritarian comes in and goes, I got this, go about your business, you don't have to worry, I'll take care of it. That's one of the subtle ways that fascism works its way into your life. I mean, you know, the railroads run on time. Mussolini was a former newspaper editor, kind of tells you he knew how to manipulate public opinion. That type of fascism is able to thrive when people are so overwhelmed with their lives close to them that the life that they lead writ large on a larger scale, they cannot fathom nor can they accept or deal with. And so what comes first, the chicken or the egg? Do you get rid of fascism by becoming involved, or by coming involved, you get rid of fascism? You've got to get involved. I don't care if it's hard. You got to do it.
I got to tell you, Brian, it really resonates, because the thing that's most disturbing to me about our politics since the insurrection last year is the willingness of a massive chunk of the American population to identify with and get inspired by fascism, by the concept that it's okay to violently assault our democratic institutions to seize political power. And that is fascism in a nutshell. And then, of course, you know, the having the great autocrat at the top of the heap who refuses to accept democracy as the legitimate way we select our leaders in this country. That is fascism. And so I hope that something will get out of the Zelensky inspiration and the Ukrainian inspiration, which I do believe is seeping into the American psyche about, wow, look at what they're doing, is that we will get a little bit of this air that you're talking about, this oxygen pumped back in to us, that you know what? There are things worth fighting for. There are systems of governance that matter. There are principles upon which we should stand and fight for. And fascism is not one of those, right? And Zelensky is really role modeling for us as much as he is for the Ukrainian people.
That's why I went over there. I had to see it for myself. Ukrainian people are very, very enthusiastically behind him. They've Putin did something that no one thought was possible. He united Ukrainian people who are very divisive as the American people are. It's inspiring to see. And I hope we do draw the right lesson from it. We don't need, we don't need a ride. We need ammunition. Well, we need what we don't need is more BS. We need enlightenment. We need education, and we need communication.
Brian, we're glad you're safe. We're glad you joined us. And everybody, I think everybody watching is on board with what we said. We got to get involved. We got to be educated to fight fascism. But since you didn't answer this question, we're going to come back to it in future episodes.
We also,
you talked about it, fascism in the U.S., the real danger right now. And let's remember, President Biden's going to Poland. They're not exactly the most democratic country either. We're enabling other bad guys, and we should not normalize it. We're going to have to deal with them to beat Putin, but we got to be careful what behavior and what type of autocracy we normalize as a United States. If freedom is going to march, we got to lead the way.
Well, and I'll say this: I don't normalize the kebab in Poland either. It's a sin to put soggy French fries in the middle of a sandwich and poison me for 2 days. That's the biggest.
Oh no!
Well, in honor of Greek Independence Day, go get a good souvlaki.
I had a great souvlaki. They did have good Greek food there, but the kebab, stay away from, baby. That's the biggest sin in Poland.
Thanks Brian. Thanks Joel. Man. Thanks everyone for joining Warning Shot. See you next week.
Thanks for watching Warning Shot, a new look at foreign policy. Download the podcast wherever you find your podcast, and we'll see you next time. Russia, Russia, Russia.